Welcome to the Dental Implant Podcast with your host, Pav Kara, your source of knowledge for all things relating to dental implants. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you learned something valuable. I hope.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the next episode of the Dental Implant Podcast. Right. Do you notice I promised you that I would try to upload more regularly, and here I am. Okay, so I eventually kept my promise, although I made it several times first, but here we are again. Okay, what I want to do today, folks, is slight change of tactic today, and I want to introduce you to my accountant, Bilal Ahmed of Heath Hill Green. And what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about profitability in business and how to make implants profitable, because a lot of people assume that just because you do implants that you're going to be able to be profitable in business, and that's not necessarily the case. There are mistakes that I made earlier on in my career which I no longer make because I've got Bilal looking after me, but I want to qualify that whatever we talk about today, patient care always comes first. And I've said this on a number of occasions. If you hunt the money, patients can smell it. Okay. Yeah. If you genuinely look after the patients, the business looks after itself. But you need to understand how the business works in order for that to happen. Okay. So I've never been a fan of do whatever it takes to generate income from a patient, because I turn away a lot of patients. Okay. I turn a lot of patients who, you know, they need dual arch of implants and they've only got the budget for one. And I just turn around and say to them, it's not for you. Or they're looking for a cheap option. I just turn around and say, look, there's plenty of people out there who can help you. That's not the type of treatment that I do. So a little bit of background about what I used to do before I introduce you to Bilal. Then Bilal will expand a little bit about himself. And if you're watching on YouTube, you'll see Bilal kind of like shaking his head as we're going through this. Because earlier on in my career, I wasn't really proactive with my accounting. So I had no idea what my profitability was. I've spoken openly that when I had my own practice, it ultimately led to my bankruptcy. And when I was getting into implants or anything, I didn't really have a business plan. It was, I want to learn this. I will throw as much money as what I need to at this. And it's been a hard struggle for me, but there are smarter ways of doing this. Okay, so Bilal, I'm sure that you hear a lot where people are just like, oh, you know what, I've just spent X amount without planning it this year. Right. Like, oh, what you're doing. So Bilal, introduce yourself to those listening and then we'll get into it. And feel free to tell me off for what I just said as well, because you know that that's not the case at the moment. No. I have a meeting with your team every single month, so I've got a full track of what's going on in my businesses. So, and Bilal's got no problem standing around and saying to me, you want that investment? You can't do it yet. So,
and I think that's, so I'll introduce myself. Hi, I'm Bilal Ahmed and Chief Accountant at Heath Hill Green. That's us there. We're dental specialist accountants, but the goal for us is around the business of dentistry, because I realize I'm evangelical about this, and I think tax is a byproduct of good planning. Now, I realize I approached the conversation somewhat incorrectly, which is I seem to, oh no, tax is a byproduct. We'll come to that. And I think it puts a lot of people, not off, but I think it puts some people on tenterhooks, which is, oh, well, but am I going to pay more tax? Our strap line is we don't want you to pay a penny more than you have to, but tax is a byproduct of strategy. So if you want to pay as little tax as possible, then it has to come with effective planning. The two go hand in hand, because I mean, we've had this with clients where they've joined us after the tax year has ended. They've then proceeded to ignore us. And this is a real example where a client joined us in July, so 3 months after the tax year had ended. Tax year ends on the 5th of April. He then joined us in, I think it was August or July, and then proceeded to ignore us until about December. We get to the tax return, but he's had a phenomenal year. We give him a number that he's not happy with, and he was really, really unhappy. So really, I joined you guys for strategic guidance, and I'm not happy with the service. I'm not happy with the number. And, you know, if you feel that way, it's valid, and we want to discuss that. So there's two things there. One is, if you've joined me after the tax year has ended, there's nothing I can do in that. It's akin to asking for a filling once the tooth has been extracted. It's gone. The tax year is done. But also, if you want strategic guidance, you have to respond to us. Like, you've got to be talking to us. We can't get to the point where your submission is due in a couple of weeks and then see what you can do, because that's now tax avoidance. That's illegal. We never want to get anywhere near that. So with effective tax planning around a strategy, around a framework, that's what we espouse. That's what we're built around, is we want to be speaking to you regularly. We want to understand what your objectives are, but, you know, short, medium, and long. So short term, I would define as anything in the next 12 months. Medium is anything between sort of a year and 3 or 4 years. And then beyond that is that there's a long-term objective. So just give you an idea of something like that is, I want to be able to put 20 grand a year into my pension. You know, that's a very short-term objective. That's something we can work with. The medium-term objective would be, Bilal, I'm looking to move home. This is the type of house we're looking for. These are the costs associated to do that. So, and I'm going to need 50 grand for stamp duty. I'm going to move in costs. I'm going to need to put carpets in the new house. And that's a medium-term objective. And a longer-term objective might be, I want to start investing in property for my kids, or I want to start investing so that I can reduce my dental income and start taking investment income. Or I want to start investing now because by the time I get to 50, I want to retire. And all three of those objectives are completely valid. And it's really all about effective planning. So to give you an idea of what that looks like, we had a conversation with a client who said, Bilal, I want to start investing in property. Fantastic. So we sat down and we did a full planning exercise. We looked at his personal spend. How much money does it cost him to be him? And we worked out that he needed about 4 grand a month after all taxes. And that's him sorted. So about 50 grand a year. Well, we worked out he makes about 100 grand. So we're just shy of 100 grand. So he makes about 90 grand. And don't quote me on any of these numbers here because I'm in front of you, but I'll give you sort of ballparks. But if you make about £90,000, you're looking at about £30,000 worth of deductions. So if you make 90, you pay 30 grand in tax, national insurance, and student loan contributions, leaves you with 60. You need 50 to live. You've got 10K left over. How are you going to invest in property with 10K? You're not, are you? So we then reverse engineer that number that says, well, can we do anything with that 50K that you need to live your life on? So one of the things we looked at was his trading status. So we worked out by operating by a limited company, you could save a few quid in tax. So we built some back there. The other thing was obvious personal spend. He's got two cars in his own name that we looked at. Well, if you got electric cars through the business, he could claim as an expense and then reduces his tax base further, but also reduces how much he needs personally. Because when you take out car payments, insurance, maintenance, servicing, you know, all of that stuff, that gives you back quite a bit of money. So you no longer need 50K, you need about 40-something K. And we reduce your tax and we reduce everything else. So we've got to the point now, we started off with about 10K buffer, we've got about 18K buffer now. Still not enough to invest in property. So now we have to look at the top line number that says, well, if you now want to start investing in property, you now need to increase your income from 90K to 120K. Because once you've paid all the associated taxes, you may now be left with 30K. Does 30K get you the type of property you want to buy? No. Fine. What's the objective here? Is it to buy one a year? Is it to buy one, you know, one every couple of years? Is it to be left with three? I've got three kids. My long-term objective is I want to leave a property to each one of my children. That doesn't have to happen next year. Doesn't have to happen over the next five. It's just a strategy that I've got in place that says, as and when business, you know, dictates I've got the surplus cash flow, then I'll do that. So that's now effective tax planning backwards, because we've started with an objective. From that, we've talked about limited company because he was trading as a sole trader, and we've talked about cars, electric cars through the business. So we've achieved tax efficiency, but within the framework of an objective. Just to give you an idea then, that says if he stayed as a sole trader, I could reduce his tax bill by, you know, if he made contributions to a private pension, for instance. So if he makes contributions to a SIP, if you contribute £10,000 as a sole trader, the HMRC will uplift that to £12,500, and then you get 20% of the £12,500 off your tax bill. Fantastic. Objective achieved. But you've no longer got the cash because you put it into a pension. So tax in isolation doesn't mean anything. Now, we had a conversation with one of our practice owners in March where he just got into the habit every year of just buying new stuff. And he was about to go buy... it was an implant surgeon, to be fair. He was about to buy about 90 grand's worth of implant equipment. Now, I think he was going to buy the CEREC machine in-house so he could do the crown in-house. But he's got one already. And his throughput doesn't dictate another one. So if you've got one already that's not being used to its full efficiency, why are we buying another one just to reduce tax? So if you go buy a new bit of equipment in the UK, it's tax deductible. So if you've made 200 grand profit and you go by 100 grand on qualifying plant and machinery, you reduce the taxable profit down to 100k.
So Bill, actually on this, because I think this is where the listeners are going to gain like a lot of insight now. So we have a lot of people listening who either want to get into implants or they're in implants already and they want to progress and they need to invest in new equipment. So first thing I would say to you is, this is a question you will get a lot, is continuing education tax deductible? And secondly, if I wanted to buy equipment, let's say it's equipment that I had to have, like a surgical motor. Without that, not placing implants. Without an implant kit, we're not placing implants, okay? How do you formulate that strategy? When do you decide I have to finance this, I can put it through the business? Because a lot of people who are starting off there earlier on in their careers, they may not build up their business as much. So what's the strategy there? So question one, continuing education and whether that's tax deductible, particularly a diploma or an MSc, because I hear this a lot, okay? And then the second aspect is, how do you plan your equipment? And what conversation should you be having with your accountant to make sure that this is being done properly, with so you don't get any horrible surprises a year down the line?
Awesome. So let's go through those in order then. So the first is around continuing personal development, or CPD, or further education. So the definition in the UK for what is tax deductible is anything that's enhancing an existing skill is tax deductible. So if you currently have a skill set, so if you're a brand new dentist who's fresh out of foundation year and wanting to maybe go down the rabbit hole of implants, would be, do you have the theoretical knowledge and skill today to place the implant? Well, the short answer is yes, because dental school would have taught you that. Do you have the confidence to place an implant at the level you want? Well, the answer is no. So you need to enhance the skill set that you have in order to place the implant. So that then becomes tax deductible. With something like an MSc specifically, it's really module dependent. So it depends on the module, if you're going to go for a diploma or an MSc, whatever qualification you're going down the path of, you have to evaluate on a module by module basis that says, do each of those modules meet that definition of enhancing a new skill? So enhancing an existing skill. Because as long as that does, then it's fine to do so. You can approach accounts like us to give you an indemnified answer. It might cost you a few quid, but it saves you having to spend 30 quid and realizing 30 grand and realizing you couldn't claim as a tax deductible expense. Conversely, if you're going to go on a taster course to find out whether it's the right thing for you, then yeah, it's tax deductible because you're dipping your toe into the water of a skill set you already have. Where that definition sort of extends a bit further is, if you're going to go learn how to trade crypto and become one of those finance gurus, is no, it's got nothing to do with your scope of practice, it's got nothing to do with the work that you're doing, it's got nothing to do with anything, therefore that course would not be tax deductible. So even if it's got a tedious link, i.e. I am director of a limited company, I'm responsible for making sure that the company's assets are completely utilized, therefore I want to go on a crypto course, no, not tax deductible, does not matter. So just to sort of add to that then, is we have conversations with associates. So the timing of that expense is also really important. So we do something called accrual-based accounting. Accrual-based accounting is we follow the activity, not the cash. The default position in the UK for a sole trader is cash accounting, which is we just follow the cash, not the activity. That's flipping the other way. So the default position will be accrual-based accounting. What that means is, if I go pay 10 grand for a course in September that doesn't start until July next year, I can't claim that 10 grand cost in today's, in this tax year. So if, and that's really important for cash flow, which is, well, if you've spent 10 grand thinking you're going to reduce your tax bill by £4,200 this cycle, then it's not going to do that. Because the course didn't start until July next year, it's going to reduce next year's tax. You've just sort of robbed Peter to pay Paul. Now, we get this a lot that says, you know, same with your indemnity, for instance. If you're going to tell your indemnity that your cost has gone up and, you know, you're in September and you've paid 4 grand for your indemnity this year because you've now started placing implants, that entire 4 grand does not become tax deductible, because as a sole trader, you'll go from September to April and then April to the following April. So you're only really getting 6K, six months of that as tax deductible this year, so 2 grand of that. Which is why some people then make the decision that says, well, if I'm going to do that and do it accrual-based, I'll just pay for it monthly instead. Because if it doesn't cost me any more money, then I'll just pay for it monthly and then it's always matching the correct tax year. The second thing around tools now is also depending on, it's a really good way to manage your thresholds. So if you're starting out and you're making about 50 grand a year, Anything you earn as a sole trader up to £50,000 a year is taxed at 20%. If you operate by a limited company, any profits you have up to 50K are taxed at 19%. Anything over that, then taxed at 26.5%. And in the UK, as a sole trader, if you earn over 50K, you'll start paying tax at 40%. Or if you earn over 125K, you'll pay tax at 45%. As a sole trader in the UK, for anything you earn over 100K, so for everyone gets 12 and a half grand tax-free. However, for every £2 you earn over 100K, you start losing £1 of your personal allowance. So effectively, when you get to 125K worth of taxable income, you've lost your entire 12 and a half grand tax-free allowance, which means you've effectively paid a 60% tax between 100K and 125K. Painful. But buying your equipment is a really good way to manage those thresholds. So again, any asset that's defined as tax deductible for a business is something that's wholly and exclusively for business. I need hand tools to place implants. There's no duality of purpose. I can't use those hand tools to do some carpentry on the weekend. It doesn't work on the wrong type of tools. So if you're then going to go spend 15 grand on new tools and equipment and machinery, well, then that would reduce your taxable profit. So you've gone from 125K to 110K, which means you get back some of your personal allowance, which means that you're not paying effective rate 60% tax. So in essence, you spending 15 grand on hand tools hasn't cost you 15 grand because you're going to lose 60% of that in tax anyway. So it actually becomes quite cheap. So timing your asset purchases is really important because you can use it effectively to manage your thresholds, which then becomes really, really quite useful. Specifically, if you've got kids and you're doing an MSc and you're not expecting your income to be any more than about 65K, if your income's at 60K, you still qualify for tax-free childcare and child benefit, which is really important. If you're creeping over the 100K threshold, then and you've got two kids in childcare, that could be the difference of 24 grand a year, depending on how expensive your childcare is. Because the moment you go over 100K, you then lose access to the tax-free childcare. You only get about 15 hours, I think. So using asset purchases is really important, but the same thing applies to the timing of the asset. Just because you buy it on the 5th of April and, you know, 5 grand left your bank account on the 5th of April does not matter. It's when you physically had the asset. So it's when the risk and responsibilities and liabilities and benefits of an asset transfer to you. So just because I give you 5 grand doesn't mean I've taken the benefit of the asset. So it's only when the asset's now delivered to you. I don't have to use it. It's just there. But the risk and rewards of everything of that asset have transferred from the seller over to me. Therefore, I have the asset. It's mine. It's now tax deductible. In the UK, for any brand new assets, you get 100% tax write-off for the asset, providing it's qualifying plant and machinery under annual investment allowance or capital allowances. But the same definition applies whether you apply as a limited company or a sole trader. So quite a comprehensive answer then.
Yeah, that is a comprehensive answer. And you know what? It's really interesting because I said it's the complete opposite of what I used to do. Now, I used to go on a course. So I was like, wow, I need to buy this. I have to get it. And now when I'm doing courses, Bilal, you know, if I'm looking at like, you know, I need new instruments, I'm looking, do I need the entire kit? No. And quite often this kit's like three and a half K, but I actually need two instruments out of it, which is 300 quid.
Yeah.
But you get really excited on the day. You're like, oh, you know, if I buy this kit, it will allow me to do the same as what this guy's actually teaching.
Yeah.
Not understanding that this guy's been doing it day in and day out. You know, this surgeon's been doing it. You know, they've built up a certain skill level. It's not the instruments. The instruments are just a tool that may make that bit easier for you. So what I'm getting from you is don't just throw money into it. Okay. What's really important is to sit down with your accountant. And as I said, it's completely transformed the way that I look at it, because what's happening now is when I'm meeting with your team on a month by month basis, we're looking at, okay, this is what we've projected. How much have we actually done? This is what we've projected. How much have we actually done? Yes, we're on target for this. We're not on target for this. We're higher or lower. Why are we higher or lower? What's happened? And have we put away enough into a reserve account to cover the tax? So what that means is, I'm not stressing at the end of the year thinking, oh, what's my tax bill we're going to get? Because I've got a pretty decent idea, to be honest. And then we're now having discussions where, Pav, you know, we've got some liquidity in your reserve account, so we can possibly use that to get a little bit more equipment if you need. So these are the conversations that we're having, and they're very enriching because you're telling me, okay, Pav, you know, if you're going to buy this item of equipment, draw down half out, 50% out of the reserve account and then 50% out of the current account, and it will kind of like be equal. Yeah. And these are strategies that I don't understand. And even after these conversations, I still don't understand, but I don't need to understand them. I just need a team around me who understands it so that they can guide me appropriately. That's what it's coming down to.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
And then from our perspective, there's things like, so to answer your question on like, you know, where, why, what, and how. So internally as a business, we have one single objective when it comes to spending money is, How does it benefit our client? And a really good example of this is we got pitched a trade show. I'm not going to say which one because it's not a negative for us. It just didn't give us any value. And then that was, I think the total cost was about 15 grand. Now we know we're not the firm of accountants to stand at a trade show and start handing out leaflets because we're not trying to work with every single person that wants to use us. Ours is, well, how can we help you get to where you want to get to? Because ours is a value-based proposition. So one thing we looked at there then was, well, if that's going to cost 15 grand, how does that benefit our clients and how does that benefit anyone we want to work with? So that's a single, sort of the top line, strap line that says, how does it achieve that? If we can't get past that first test, it doesn't happen. We reallocated those funds into a series of webinars that we ran free for everybody that says, at a cost to us, at a cost to me, in the evenings that said, this is how we think we can enrich your business. And we did that and it worked really well. The other side to that is then, if it doesn't directly improve the client experience, how does it indirectly improve the client experience? So give you an example is if one of my team wants to go on a new course, well, how does it improve the client experience? Well, you have to go do that course. You then have to disseminate that information to the rest of the team. So we're all upskilled. Because if it doesn't do that, then what? The third criteria is how soon do we recover the cash that we've invested? And that's how most people use return on investment. Return on investment isn't actually used like that. Return on investment is more, if I put 100 grand into something and it gives me 7% back a year, that's my return on investment. Most people will use return on investment incorrectly when comparing it to return on cash, which is I've put 10 grand into something, how quick do I get my 10 grand back? And that's how you should evaluate any sort of purchase, any sort of training course, any sort of material purchase, in the same way that says, by buying this tool or by buying, I've currently got 3 times my magnification loops. I need 7 times magnification loops. That's potentially £7,000. Can I justify 7 grand? How does 7 times my magnification help me today? Is it direct, as in I can increase my success rate of first time fits, or does it prevent my back going so I'm taking less time off work and therefore I'm able and more present for my patients? Within that then is things like evaluating training courses. There's a cacophony of courses out there and they're all at different price points, all offering different things. And we're not here to say each one's good, bad, or indifferent. As to say, if you approach each evaluation metric consistently, you'll get something specific back. So if you've got your plan and you know your plan is to place 50 implants this year or 60 or 100, whatever that plan might be, when you go on a course, you should ask the person providing the course, how does your course help me place 50 implants this year? I'm at 36, got another 14. How can I improve my ability to place those implants? Conversely, if they can say, yes, this is how this course meets that objective, price becomes less of an issue because we've justified it. Because if one course is 15 grand and one course is 5 grand, but the 15 grand course A shows you how you can get cash back in 12 months and meet your objective, but the other course is a bit more wishy-washy, but it's 5 grand. On current face value today, we'll say the 5 grand is cheaper, we'll go for the 5 grand. But it's not, is it? Because you're not getting anything back for it. So if you now have a consistent evaluation metric, you look at everything in the same way, and it's quite selfish, that says, how does that get me to where I want to be? And that was the framing at the right start of this conversation that says, the guy that wanted to buy property. You know, how does this get me to earning 3 grand gross a day? If it doesn't, why not? How can it help me? And that's how you should evaluate your coaches, your mentors, your courses, everything. We did this with an orthodontist recently and we worked out, because he wanted to get a therapist, and we worked out what his maximum effort needs to be before he can afford a therapist, i.e. he can do 250 starts in a year. But when he gets to 260 starts now, he then needs an amount of hours for an orthodontic therapist. Then we've worked out at what point beyond 250 does he need to get to in order to justify a full-time therapist? And then at what point does that therapist also need a nurse supporting? Now we're building a business around a person because he doesn't want to own a practice. Not everyone should buy a practice. Not everyone wants to buy a practice. this person's specific objective is never to own a practice. They just want to be roaming. They want to work with a number of practices where they're the chief orthodontist. Perfect. But naturally, some people, what some people may do is go get the therapist today, not really have a justification for them, and completely kill the liquidity. And now you're stressing about something that you shouldn't be stressing about, that shouldn't be on your plate. And now it's affecting your ability to work, maybe affecting your personal life, affecting your family life. All of this could have been avoided.
So obviously, I mean, you've obviously discussed how you look at planning for your clients. So I want to use a parallel there, Bilal, because I think it's important that we talk about some of the clinical aspects of it as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain to you how I think and how I do things, and then I'll get your feedback afterwards as to how that would help an individual business, if that makes sense. Okay. So again, I've always said that, you know, patient care is always paramount. It has to be. Okay. If you're only in it for the short game, then do what you want, because eventually you'll get found out. You'll get into trouble. Something will happen. If you want to be in it for the long game, the client, the patient always comes first. Okay. So it got me thinking that, you know, what do patients actually want? And there's different patients who want different things. As you all know, there's different clients who want different things. Some patients want cheap. Fine. They are not my target. Okay. They can go to see somebody else. Okay. Other people want a very high quality job. And that's the type of person that I am. So if I need to have something done, I will always look for who's the best to do it. Who do I really trust? Who can demonstrate to me that they've got a lot of skill and that's what they do. So I'm trying to attract patients like myself. Okay. Then the other element of that as well is, we are all, as people, very, very busy on a day-to-day basis, okay? So what patients want to do, firstly, they want to come in, they want to have a good job done, okay? Secondly, they do not want 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 appointments spread over 9, 12 months.
Correct.
Okay? If it can be avoided, okay? And this is why I keep pushing the envelope on my learning and my skills, because historically, and I still know a lot of dentists do this, and please understand, I'm not saying that this is wrong to do it this way. I'm saying understand what it's doing for your business and the patient's perspective of it, okay? Some dentists will place an implant and completely bury it and then leave it for 5, 6 months for it to heal. And then they will uncover the implant in another 40-minute appointment. They'll wait another month, 2, 3, 4 months for it to heal. They'll then get the patient back and take impressions, and then they'll then say, so you're talking about sometimes 6 or 7 appointments for a straightforward procedure where the patient's, A, their treatment time is over 6, 9 months, but B, it's multiple appointments as well. These are busy people who are paying your fees.
Yep.
And you are demanding more and more time for them to take off work, which either they have to take unpaid or as a sick day. Okay. Yep. Patients don't like that. So I always thought to myself, well, how can I accelerate this process without compromising on quality? And that's been my go-to. So this is why now the processes that I do, and please understand, I'm not recommending people do this and unless they learn from me, like how I do it. Because, you know, I've talked about implant decarbonization, all sorts of stuff before. And all of these things add up, okay? In certain cases, I can deliver the implant and the definitive crown at the same visit, okay? And in a lot of other instances, I can place the implant and scan the patient at that point. So at the next appointment, we are delivering the crown for them. Right. So doing it in 1 or 2 visits as opposed to 4 or 5 visits, okay? What's the clinical upside of that? The clinical upside of that is implants don't like connections on and off multiple times. There's this concept called one abutment, one time, okay? So actually, if I can place the implant and the definitive crown at the same patient, biologically, that's better for the patient. That's why I'm saying patient always comes first,
yeah.
Okay? But from a business point of view, what I'm doing is I'm magnifying my hourly rate, which for me is arguable that, okay, from a skill point of view, it's justifiable. You know, and the other thing that I can do as well is, you know, there are techniques out there, documented techniques, not just shit that I've made up off the top of my head. Okay. I'm not that smart. I just copy what other people do. Okay. I learn what other people, I'm good at copying other people. I'm not that smart. Okay. And a lot, there's so many techniques out there where you can place the implant and graft at the same time. You know, and I'm talking about immediate implant placement. So a lot of people say that, you know, if there's not enough bone, you can't place an immediate implant. It's like, I've done it thousands of times. There's a lot of information out there on this extent. You know, we've discussed VST technique with Prophet El Askari a few episodes ago. But what I'm saying, Bilal, is that if we put patient or client first, figure out what they want and help them achieve it, they are then in return happy to pay for that good service.
Exactly. And that, I mean, you there's a nice little segue there. So what you just described is, I as an accountant do not need to understand how you do what you do. I just need to understand the steps it takes for you to do how you want to do it. Because if you can identify your overhead costs, so let's say in a 40-hour week, you have 22-hour surgical. Yeah, maximum, because of your admin time, your downtime, the days you work, travel. Let's say there's 22 hours maximum surgical that you could offer. And of that 22 hours, you're really only effective 16 hours of time because your diary's never booked up the way you want it to. So if we've got 16 hours and we multiply that out by 48 weeks because, you know, life happens, that then tells me you've got a total of 768 hours where you could be placing actually cash generating work, for instance. So we can then reverse engineer that. That then says, if your overhead costs are 20 grand a year, so if your overhead costs are 28 grand a year, 20 grand a year, that's the cost of continued development that you know you're going to have in your budget for the next 5 years. So then we know that cost exists. The cost of your mobile phone, your indemnity, your GDC, any other subscriptions that you might have, accountancy fees, legal fees, whatever you've got. I know then we've got £20,000 worth of costs divided by 768 hours. Each hour costs you £26. Yeah, for instance. Therefore, you know what the overhead cost for your time is before anything else. So when we work out what your overhead cost is, we can overlay the cost of the materials, the cost of the treatment, and the amount you're giving back to the principal. You can work out straight away how much profit you've made on that treatment per hour. And you should be walking into that knowing that, because that then allows you to price your cases correctly. Because if you need to have X amount at the end of the year's profit, you can already work it out on a case-by-case basis. Because you could go back and identify, this is how I like to see my patients. This is the amount of time I like to spend with my patients. Therefore, the cost associated to all of that. If each of that's going to cost you, let's say 10 hours, then that's £260 of your overhead cost. There's a surgical cost of where you're working, and then you've got to fit all that in as well, because the principal will want profitability. You'll want profitability, and there's the cost of materials as well. Now, what you can do ahead of that is, if you know your business plan is to place 200 implants this year, you can go to your supplier straight away and say, I'm going to need 200 implants off you this year, full kits, not paying the price I paid last year, because it gives you a negotiation point now. But if the journey for you is, I like to do it this way, and someone else's journey is, I like to do it that way, it's neither right, neither wrong from our perspective. As to say, if you want to do it that way, this is how much it's going to cost you, this is how much you're going to have to charge.
Yeah.
And in order to deliver that, and if you're delivering a Rolls Royce experience, you've got to charge Rolls Royce money.
Oh, just a couple of things, because I know we're on a time frame, because I need to head out soon as well to get to work as well. So I've got admin this morning. So firstly, again, another parallel. Okay. Patient comes in to see me, a client comes in to see you. Diagnosis first, then the treatment plan.
Correct.
Diagnosis and treatment plan are patient / client specific. There's no difference between the two. Okay. Secondly, get your calculator out again. I'm going to ask you again, right? So of those hours that you said, 700, whatever it was, if I turned around and said to you, or not to you, because you don't place implants, right? But if I turned around and said to you, look, I can show you techniques. And on average, because you can't do these types of accelerated protocols with all implant cases. But if I said on average, I can save you, let's say 30% clinical time. Mm-hmm. What impact does that have on for the business? I'll let you decide like what metrics you want to throw out.
That's 230 extra hours. So if you know you've got maximum surgical time of 768 hours and you can save that, that's 30 more. That's 230 more hours you've recovered, and that's now more implants you can place. So
more time you can take off with your kids.
Well, I've already factored that in. Because there's certain definitive parameter that we will always work with, which is what are your non-negotiables? If you're currently working 6 days and we can save you 30%, then that's more time with your kids. If we're working with someone who already says, I will not work a Friday, I only work half a Thursday, I have this, my hours are finite. If you can then build in 30% of efficiency, that's more starts that they can have in the year, which I was talking about the orthodontist, because his is exactly that, that says, I do half a day Thursday admin, I never work a Friday, I've got 3.5 days to start treatments. So by having the efficiencies put in place, it means you can do more starts. And that's the way we look at it. And you're absolutely right. It's intrinsic. It's down to the individual. Whenever we work with an associate who's currently working 6 days, we tell them they're going to burn out. They're going to have a really, really, really bad time in about 18 months. It's not sustainable. So it's what does that 30% mean to you?
Well, you know what? This has been amazing. And I hope that those listening can see why I like you. Because you know what? I've had accountants before in the past where I've liked them personally. But you know what? When it comes to accounting, it's just like, I don't want to know. Here's everything. Just tell me how much I need to pay. And then they come back to me with a figure. I'm like, are you sure that's right? That can't be right. I've had bad advice in the past as well. And, you know, I had my fingers burnt. And it's nice working with yourself where I feel in safe hands. And, you know, obviously with our monthly meetings, I'm a lot more confident with regards to what's going on, okay? What I would say is you almost make accounting interesting to a dentist. And that's the biggest accolade I can give you. It's certainly more interesting than endo, that much I can say. So.
Appreciate you.
You know what? I hope those listening can see that the importance of business planning, and we've only been able to scratch the tip of the iceberg today, because there is so much to it. You know, Bill, I was thinking as well, you know, maybe that, you know, you and I should get together and get to and formulate some sort of mini course or you know, a 1 or 2 day event where we can go into this in a lot more detail. You know, obviously you can cover the business side and I'll cover part of the clinical side as well. So that's something that perhaps we should look at if people are interested.
Eventually. Just very quickly on that is, so I love that kind of thing. The reason why I love that kind of thing, so I did this at Dental and Tubules last week where we had a workshop. We had four principals, two practice managers, we had an associate and someone adjacent to the industry. And what we did is we showed them how you would build a business plan. And we workshopped it. And the benefit of that is if you've got 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people around the table, we've got our view of what it could look like. When you start bouncing ideas off your peers and your cohorts, you then, why am I not doing it that way? Oh, why don't I build that into my plan? Then you go, well, why are you spending that? And it comes really it becomes significantly more powerful than it comes from us, because you're talking to your peers and you're not being talked at, you're talking with. The other side of it is we have no influence on that top line number, i.e., like Pav said, you know, 30% efficiency. We could never, it would be massively disingenuous for us to say, this is how you place an implant, this is how you can do more efficiency, cut this bit out, because that's how you end up with really shitty cars, because when the accountants get involved, you start losing cup holders. Is with people like Pav being there then, is you can then say, Bella, we can't do it that way because that does not reinforce the patient journey. That does not improve the patient journey. It causes complications or it'll add appointments later down the line. So having that workshop and experience where we can sit down in a room together and have us together for like 8 hours, 8 to 10 hours, that would be really quite useful. And I think it'd be massively productive sessions.
Yeah. And you know, it's, you know, helping people with their, improving their clinical efficiency is what I do well. Cause obviously when you get into implants, you've got a certain baseline. But then, you know, as you start to progress and you build your skills, that's when you can turn around and say, you know what? That's irrelevant. I can combine this with this. I can do this. If I do this, I'm going to go. And I'm not saying it's the right thing to do for everybody because it is a journey. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is, it is possible if you have the right mindset, the right attitude, the right patient base behind you, and you're ready to learn. Then you know, and I've said it to a lot of people. You know, where you know, like for example, I was having a conversation recently. You know, everybody's talking about photogrammetry and full arch. I know this might be a bit confusing for you, but basically, people are talking about workflows to go digital in full arch. And it's expensive, and they're like, oh, you know, they can expedite it. And I'm like, once the implants are in, I can do the restorative phase going analog, so nothing digital, just manual impressions, get everything to drop in place in 2 30-minute appointments. That's it. That's all that I need. And it's only because I've figured out over the years, well, actually, I can combine this and this and this. And it's not cutting corners. It's just being efficient with your time. And that's what it comes down to. So, yeah, we'll discuss that in a bit more detail, mate. So,
Bilal, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it. And thank you all for listening in. Please, folks, check out the academyofimplantexcellence.com. All the modules are on there. We're still recording. It's turning into an absolute behemoth. You can get the modules individually. You can spread the payment over 12 months, just £250 a month. If that's not accessible for you, then maybe implants isn't for you. So, Bilal, thank you so much. Take care. Yeah.